All right, once again, this is Film Study with Tim McCusick. This is episode number 9 as we look back at the week 4 loss at home to the Pittsburgh Steelers, 26-9. Ken McCusick, how are you doing?
Life is good, Josh. How about you?
Life is good. The Ravens are not good. I think if there's anything, looking back at this game, last week was a devastating loss. The game in London, Jaguars, worst loss in Ravens history, I believe.
Very close. It was two 37-point losses in Ravens history.
Okay. But we thought we could come home and move past that. I feel like this one's much more of a sting, looking so bad against the Steelers.
It's a painful loss, and I think it has a lot more relevance to how good the Ravens really are going to be that they lose a game at home to the Steelers like this, as opposed to going to London. We can come up with a lot of excuses, ending with Pietrangelo, so right. Why the Ravens didn't play well there. But against the Steelers, to lose a game and lose this convincingly was very bad.
Can we just play the Browns and the Bengals every week? Or I don't even know if it's that easy. Maybe if we can just bring back some injuries. The injuries have killed us. I mean, this season's starting to look like it's going to be a tough year for the Ravens.
Well, I'm not going to get myself completely down by a 2-game losing streak of this nature. You know, they lost to a not great team, but not terrible team in London, and then lost to one of the best teams in the AFC at home pretty convincingly. That's bad. But, you know, it'll be a little bit worse if they go to Oakland and lose, but I still won't give up because 2-3 coming out of the toughest point in the schedule I think is going to be not wholly unexpected and not something they can't possibly come back from.
Yeah, but what about the fact that the Oriole fans are a little ahead of this? We've been dealing with this for a few years, and now Raven fans also have to come to focus on this, of the man that you paid the big bucks to immediately after the biggest career season of his career, and now he's not doing so much.
Well, that's true, and there's not much the Ravens can do about it. I mean, it'll be a huge organizational decision when they decide that Joe Flacco has to go. I'm not there yet. I think that, you know, you have to give them time to work through these injuries, and the rest of the team, frankly, is too good to give up on this team. The defense is too darn good to give up on it. I mean, they won a Super Bowl with Trent freaking Dilfer. Come on, it's possible that they can still come back with Flacco.
I get that, and we're going to break down the defense in a minute, and we've got plenty to talk about on the defense because they were on the field most of the game.
Yeah, that's true. It's horrible.
And I get that you can win, and we've seen the Ravens win with a defensive game plan. It's been frustrating the past couple weeks where the offense isn't even just stabilizing a little bit.
Well, that's true. I mean, they've had a lot of trouble doing anything. They really only had one big play. Actually, maybe you call it two. The touchdown pass from Flacco to Wallace, and then the long run by Collins. And Collins, of course, every time you give him the football, it's like throwing the pass to the guy in the what's the game where they go back and play the high school, the movie where they go play the high school football game again. You know what I'm talking about? There's Robin Williams in it and Kurt Russell. Never seen it. Well, you're quite too young.
Robin Williams and Kurt Russell, I do not know.
Okay, it's like the best of times or something. It's called. They go back and they play a football game, and then he gets to make the catch at the end of the game. And of course, he can barely hold on to the football at all, and that's part of the physical comedy of it.
Okay. Gotcha. Well, Ken, this is where I remind you that I am only 37 years old.
I gotcha. So 17 years older here, and I've seen a few more movies from the 1980s.
But let's stay in the 30s for a moment, because the one good thing the Ravens did, there was a few little things, but the highlight for the defense this past week was they held Antonio Brown to 34 yards.
Yes, and that really was something special. Antonio Brown, since the beginning of the 2013 season, which is when he really broke out, has played 75 football games, including the playoffs, and he has only been held under 39 yards twice. Once of those was against Arizona in 2015, and then again yesterday by the Ravens. So they did a wonderful job on him. They completely locked him down, and in fact, the only turnover was a ball that Jimmy Smith kept him from getting a catch on that popped up into Weddle's hands and went for the interception. We talk about that a little later.
Yeah.
So great job on Antonio Brown.
And that was clearly that was the Ravens' game plan, was let's take Antonio Brown, the best player on the field, out of the game. And they did that.
They did. They did a very good job at it.
Okay, so they did that. Then what? Why didn't it work? How'd the game fall apart?
So how'd the game get lost? Well, you know, the game is lost on the edge primarily. And when I say that, I mean the Steelers were able to run consistently off the edge. They didn't get a lot done in the middle. The Ravens were effective at stopping the run in the middle of the field. But when they ran to the edge, they got big chunks of yardage. That included 12 plays of 6-plus yards in total. I believe one of those was up the middle. The rest were all off the edge. Now, a lot of things were going on that. And the first tendency you have is to blame the edge setters when that happens. Now, let's talk a little bit about this, Josh, because we want to teach a few people, maybe know a little bit less about football, kind of what's going on. But an edge setter is typically an outside linebacker who's the last line of defense to keep the play to the inside. And that player is responsible for turning the leverage of the play a little bit to the inside so that he can make sure that it's difficult, if not impossible, for the running back to get around him. He at least should delay the guy, but hopefully he can actually contain the guy and force him to the inside where other large men are to tackle him, including the middle linebackers and the defensive linemen. So it's typical you blame the edge setter when a team has success running off the edge. But I don't believe that's really where the problem lay in this game.
Okay, so they had a lot of success running off the edge, but you're saying it's not the linebacker's fault. That's not the reason why he was.
It
wasn't a containment problem.
No, there were containment problems, and the outside linebackers there do share some of this responsibility. But I don't think it was the primary reason. I think basically the primary reason was the Steelers pulled an amazing amount in this game, and I've got to count up the total number of pulls on run plays, but it's more than I've ever seen the Ravens do. And the Ravens used to have a tremendous game of pulling where Grubbs and Yanda would alternate pulls all the time. I thought there was one game that might have more pulls in it, but I look back and they had a total of 19. And I'm going to guess that the Steelers might have pulled 30 times in this game, maybe.
Okay. All right. Let's take a step back. When you say the Steelers pulled, what do you mean?
Okay. So a pull is when a lineman pulls out of his normal position and goes to lead a run play that's headed to the other side. So the typical action is a left guard will pull to the right on a run to the right, or a right guard will pull to the left on a run to the left. And you can also do that with tight ends, and you can, in fact, do it with other positions as well. It's just not as common. You might pull with the center occasionally, or even pull with the tackle, and that means he's going outside the tight end typically. That's called a one-gap pull, as opposed to a long pull is when you go from guard on one side and you go all the way to the other side.
All right, so you're using your line to make more space.
That's right. It's a power running game. Guys with a full set head of steam like that, running with a guard, can take people out, and there's almost nobody who can stop a pulling guard. They're like, it's like trying to stop an elephant. But on the other hand, those plays take a long time to develop, so if you get penetration against them, you can beat the system. You can disrupt it.
All right. Okay. So then, is it a penetration problem this week for the Ravens?
Yes. In fact, I believe it was a penetration problem. That it was really happening. Let me just take a moment here. Turn off my phone. This is really professional, I know, but we'll do that.
This is a podcast. This isn't the radio.
You can get away with a lot, huh? All right, we're all set now. Now nobody's mailbag questions will get interrupted. But you were asking about...
Is it a penetration problem?
Is yes.
The problem is that the Ravens couldn't penetrate? They were given too much time in that backfield for this to develop?
That's right. So these pulls were developing. They're slow developing, but the way to prevent it is you have Brandon Williams, who we didn't have, unfortunately, or Brent Urban, who we didn't have, unfortunately, or Michael Pierce... bowl into the backfield, push back the center or either of the guards, and that makes it very difficult to get that pull started. And if it does get started, there can be tripping, there can be other disruption, which forces the lineman to take a different path, and that allows, generally speaking, the defenders to get more quickly to the outside and be there first to stop the play. Well, it didn't happen in this game, and a large portion of it was Bronson Cafusi, who was new, really only got one significant penetration during the entire game that stopped a run. Henry was mostly used for pass plays, Willie Henry. Davis was in there and got one or two penetrations, and Pierce only really had two penetrations, one of which was a missed tackle. So those were my notes on these guys. That's not enough. And Brandon Williams will often get five in a game and all by himself. So, they needed more to disrupt that, to get the Steelers thinking about it, and they just did not get it done. And that meant the Steelers were constantly getting two or even three guys to the edge where we really only had one guy to take care of them.
Yeah, it was noticeable watching the game that the Ravens were not penetrating like they normally do against the Steelers, with just how clean Big Ben was for the game.
Yeah, well, he was kept fairly clean. I did think they got better push on the pass rush, so they kept Ben in check. I mean, he didn't have a great game. He had one touchdown, one interception, rating a little under 80. So the Ravens did their job enough, and they kept Antonio Brown in check. But what really didn't work out, honestly, was the fact that the Ravens got kept on the field with this power running game. And they had the first drive set the tone for the entire game, but it was, 15, 16 plays, and they started at their own 3-yard line after a great punt, and they went all the way down to inside the 10-yard line or so before they kicked a field goal. So that time on the field took an immediate gassing for the Ravens defense, and I don't know that they ever recovered, and the Steelers dominated time of possession the rest of the way.
Right, and the Steelers did come out with the game plan that it has to be, we saw how you played in London, we know you've got injuries up front, we're just going to run the ball and run the ball and run the ball.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I think it was a very good game plan by the Steelers. They put in a sixth offensive lineman for 15 plays. What was even worse was, honestly, Josh, their tight ends just killed our edge rushers, too. So their tight ends, Vance McDonald, he's the guy they signed kind of towards the end of camp. And he's ended up being a really good blocker for them. And I can't stand how valuable he's been for the Steelers so far. But he had four really key blocks on run plays in this game that I noted. And that's a shame. Your outside linebackers, when you lose to a tight end, that's a bad loss. When you lose to a pulling guard, you can accept that one.
Right. I guess the good thing about the fact that it was a 26-9 loss is that it's not a close game. It's not a situation where we can blame the refs on this game, because there were some questionable calls where Raven fans could be upset about, with the 2-point conversion that got called back, which on television looked like it got to the white. And then the bigger play is the interception that they whistled dead without giving the chance for the play to play out.
That's right, and that was very disturbing. A couple things about this. So to just describe the point in the game we're at, third down, the Steelers threw a short pass to Antonio Brown. Jimmy Smith disrupted the initial play a little. Antonio Brown never really got his handle on the ball. He went to the ground without having possession. The ball popped up off his body as he hit the ground, right into the hands of Weddle. Weddle runs it in for six. Except there was a whistle in the middle of there from somebody. We assume it was an official and not somebody in the stands. But anyway, there was a whistle, and the play at that point is dead. Now, the thing that officials are told is don't risk blowing a play dead early. If you can't really tell, don't blow the play dead. Just allow it to play out, and you can unravel it later with whoever else might have seen it. So anyway, they blew it on this one. I'm sure the Ravens will not be enthralled to know that there's a possibility an official may get downgraded for that move, but that doesn't really help the Ravens. This is a big football game they lost, and this hurt. I mean, the Ravens could lost 4 points on that play, and because of it, they lost another point on that 2-point conversion you just mentioned, because they would have gone for one.
It was a big play because it was also a big momentum shift. The difference of that interception to a field goal versus that interception, touchdown immediately, and Steelers back out on the field is a big momentum shift.
Yeah, so. I agree. And I think it could easily have been 19-14. If you this is kind of what John Miller used to refer to as the fallacy of the predestined play, because we're assuming that everything would have been the same afterwards. But the Ravens had a good run going. They got the touchdown pass to Wallace shortly thereafter, after a big run by Collins. So, they had some good things happening, but this was a big gut punch to have this play stopped.
Yeah, this was a fun play for an instant replay, because at first when you saw it, you said, well, there's no way clearly it's down or he's incomplete or something's going on. And then the more they show the replay, you say, well, actually, maybe this is an interception. Mm-hmm. To the point that the announcers, if you're watching the game on TV, said, oh, okay, well, this might be an interception. And then at that point you said, all right, well, there's no way they call it an interception. And they did. So it went the Ravens' way when it seems like challenges don't often go John's way.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's true. I think most challenges fail, and Harbaugh doesn't have a great challenge record as opposed to other coaches. So you I think you're right on the money there. There's something else I didn't like about it, and that's that the officials, when the referee first announced what happened, he said the call on the field is the runner's a catch with the runner's forward progress stopped.
Right.
Well, I don't think anybody saw that. They saw it down by contact, maybe. Okay, right. That your knee went down and he had possession of the ball. But they did not see forward progress stopped. That's ridiculous. But the reason he said it, go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, I agree. I was confused with the forward progress stop because forward progress tells me, okay, well, it plays over before he even hits the ground.
That's right. And not only that, it's not reviewable. So
okay,
it's kind of like changing the narrative so that the play is not reviewable. But Harbaugh made the point that the catch was reviewable even if the forward progress was so, not.
Okay, so that's why when they said the Ravens are challenging an interception, which seemed weird to everyone, thinking, oh, it's a fumble and then a grab, but they challenged an interception because they were challenging that it was not a catch.
That's correct. That's correct. So anyway, at least we got the interception, still killed the momentum. Not the only reason the offense really put the damper on the game in the end, but it was a shame.
All right. Well, real quick, while we're discussing the quick whistle, it also brings me to: have you ever seen a crowd whistle before?
Now, you know what? We were at the Patriots playoff game the last time the Ravens played there in 2000 after the 2014 season, and a guy behind us in the row behind us was dressed up in a referee outfit, and he had a whistle around his neck. Now, he should have even been allowed in the park at that point, but somebody, some officiating person from the event crew came up and said, okay, you got to get out of here. You got to give us the whistle. Everybody up around swore up and down the guy wasn't blowing it. And he wasn't. He didn't blow the whistle. But then an enormous guy was sent back from the event staff to say, we need to take that whistle from you. You can come back, get it from us later. So they're very serious about that. A whistle from the stands can really mess up a game. So
I agree. And yeah. I was shocked. I'd never seen that before. Yeah. That I was like, how could they allow someone in with a whistle?
Yeah.
And it was the whistle. And how can a whistle in the crowd be loud enough that everyone on the football field stops? And I've never been on a football field wearing a football helmet with a bunch of other guys to know, but I always thought the crowd noise is noise and you run all that out. And the fact that a whistle, you're so tuned, I guess, to that whistle sound that it stopped play, which I hadn't seen before.
Well, that's exactly it, Josh. Is that you are tuned into the whistle and you listen. That's the sound you're listening to. It's kind of like listening to the sound of the voice you really want to hear in a bar. You know, you can tune in on that, but not necessarily everything else.
Right, I got you. Yet they never seem to hear the whistle when it's to stop a play that they think they're going to get a touchdown on. You know, they always play it out. All right. Well, let's talk about this team because we're hurt with Urban and Brandon Williams. How do we go forward? How do we handle the pass rush that just kind of decimated the team this week?
I really don't think the pass rush was that terrible. That's the funny thing. I mean, they did some things schematically that were different. They only got one sack on Ben, but they hit him a number of times. Three by Zadarius Smith, two by Willie Henry. There might have been another one in the game too, but those are the five at least that I remember.
That's true. I guess Ben's best plays were his little shovel passes, just dumping the ball off before he got hit.
Well, it was a very safe passing game, that's for sure. And those shovel passes are low risk passes. They had a couple screens. You know, when they threw the ball over the middle of the field, they were throwing to single covered open receivers many times in stride to get some yak. They threw some short passes to the outside. And the balls they did throw down the field, they didn't really take chances with. So the only pass that got intercepted was this little short pass to the right when the Ravens ran a really odd pass rush. It's something I call a 5-3 pass rush. They had five guys rushing, It included three blitzers, and they also had three guys dropping from the line of scrimmage. So it's a complex shift of things. But it was the one pass rush that really worked for the Ravens, and it turned into an interception there when Smith made a good play on the ball, and Weddle was right there to take advantage of it.
Okay. So you think that's the key, is more stuff like that, more deception going forward?
Yeah, they had four deceptive pass rushers in this game, which is up from the last couple games. They had nine individual blitzes in this game. And we've talked a little bit about this. That means a yard and a half off the line of scrimmage or coming from no closer than the slot receiver.
Right.
So Webb, in fact, he plays slot corner, and he blitzed five times off the slot in this game. He had a sack. He had a quarterback hit. And he looked pretty good in the game. They had Mosley blitz twice, Correa once. I'm trying to bring up the other one in mind as to who got the last one. It's in my article. Please go look at it out there. But nine total is substantially more than Pease had been blitzing. So that was the largest component of deception that came back this week.
Okay. All right, well, let's not break down every single player. And let's just go with a few individual players and talk about how they did this week as we've been watching them progress now through 4 weeks of football. Mm-hmm. So let's start with Willie Henry.
Okay, so Willie Henry getting his first significant playing time. Last week he got, I think it was 40 plays in his first game, and this week he came back, looked very good, and he looked very good as a pass rusher, and that's just what the Ravens need on the defensive line. So he had 15 pass snaps. It's not a lot of opportunity. He rushed the passer on all of those. Had two quarterback hits, two passes defensed, and he also drew a holding call on DeCastro. Now, that's very important when in terms of who draws penalties. It's always something I look for because oftentimes that's as good as a sack, or that's, you know, it gives the defense a free play in terms of the outcome. If it's positive for them, they take it. If it's not, they take the 10 yards. And so who draws penalties is very significant.
Okay. Did Michael Pierce really have seven tackles?
Yeah, he had seven tackles. Six of them were run stuffs. Okay, so very unusual for an interior lineman to have that many tackles. And six of them were run stuffs. Now, run stuffs are a defined statistic made up by Football Outsiders where you have to get less than a certain percentage of the yards on each down. So if you get 4 yards or less on, 40% or less of the yards to gain on first down, you have a stuff. If it's 60% or less on second down, you have a stuff. And if it's less than the full 100%, then you get a stuff on third down. So that's how that works. And okay. Pierce had six.
So
that's
good,
a lot.
Good game for Pierce.
It was a good game in terms of the stuffs. He honestly didn't do the job in terms of the amount of backfield penetration, as we talked about earlier. They needed him more than anyone else, because he's the only one left, to get some penetration and disrupt the pull.
Okay. How about Patrick Onwazer?
Okay. Well, now, he had a solid game. Now, there's been this back-and-forth struggle between him and Correa now that's lasted since training camp, and frankly, he's getting very old. Now, they're 4 weeks into the regular season. It's time to get a guy that can play and stick with him. I don't think as a platoon you're gaining any big advantage in terms of rest. So, Onwuso had a great game in this one. He had a number of tackles where he made the play, but he didn't get tackle credit. And some of those he actually deserved tackle credit, and other times he just blew up the play. But if you look at his tackles, he only had three for the game. But take a look at what he actually did, it was a lot more impressive than that. And the one play that really reminds a lot of Ravens fans, I think, of a play from Super Bowl 35 was him chasing down Bell. I think actually it wasn't Bell, it was Connor, wasn't it? Him chasing down Connor from the right side, the offensive right side, all the way to the left. And Ray Lewis did that same thing to Tiki Barber in Super Bowl 35 in one of the really well-known plays.
Sure.
Play appeared to be blocked well ahead. Would have been a big gain, but Onwuso caught him and took him down.
Gotcha. So then what does that mean for Correa?
Well, Correa didn't have a great game. He only made two tackles, one of those was a... You know, it was a gimme as the last man to a scrum, so that wasn't very impressive. He just did not do a lot. Disappeared again on the stat sheet, and he disappeared on a lot of things in terms of getting to the ball. Now, one of the things we've said about Akram in the past is that he flows very well to the outside. He has good speed, and he ought to be able to make plays to the outside. Well, that's true unless he gets caught in the wash on these run plays, and that's what seemed to happen a lot. He got either blocked by somebody or he got caught in the wash. And one of the tackles he made was on a run play that was, or I forget if it was a run or pass, but anyway, it was a 16-yard play where he got blocked out in front of the play for a number of yards, and he finally got off and made the tackle way downfield. And that's obviously not the kind of tackle right. You want to get.
So you think we'll see a little less of him?
You know, if I had to guess, progress? The way this has gone on Wiseau, we'll get the start next week. Correa had a good game the previous week in London, and he got the start this week. So I don't think the thing is decided yet. I think somebody's going to have to play well at least 2 weeks in a row.
All right. I think it was the third quarter, maybe the fourth, when there was a roughing the passer call by Za'Darius Smith.
Mm-hmm. So he got called for roughing the passer. He got a quarterback hit on a 5-yard pass. And one of the funny statistical quirks is that the 5-yard play counts, and there's a 15-yard tack on. So Za'Darius gets to keep his quarterback hit, but it's a tainted quarterback hit because it came with a roughing the passer penalty. Okay. So he got two others in the game. He wasn't bad as a pass rusher. Might have had one other pressure as well. I got to look back at my notes to make sure of that. But he had some pass rush events, just negated it with that stupid roughing the passer penalty. And it's the one you have to avoid, a clubbing action of any sort to the head. So it happens, I know. You just got to be really careful to avoid that. And Smith, of all the outside linebackers, really looked the worst against the run. He was in there a lot. And he got bent to the inside a lot. Vance McDonald had a field day with him, and so did Jesse James on the outside. He was also blocked once by a running back named Watson one-on-one. So you don't want to be beat by skill position players. Get beat by a tackle, that's okay. Get beat by a pulling guard, that's okay. Get beat by skill position players, you answer for it in the film room.
Gotcha. All right, so Humphrey, speaking of getting beat,
okay, so Humphrey had played well, of course, to now, and has been an exciting young player. Martavis Bryant beat him on consecutive plays on that last drive of the first half for 19 and 24 yards, if I recall correctly. Both plays, he just kind of lost him in the zone between the right hash and the numbers in both cases, and made some plays. Now, there's a freakish thing that has continued with Humphrey, is that the team seems to play a lot better with him on the field than with him off the field. And there's not a good reason that I can see for this, other than he's played pretty well personally. But this game, they got 2.2 yards per rush with him on the field on 11 rushes, and 6.2 per pass for 4.5 overall. So this game, it was 4.5 yards with him in the game, 5.8 without him in the game. Not statistically significant in and of itself, but for the year, the Ravens have allowed only 3.4 yards with him in the game and 5.8 without him. That's a big difference, and Humphrey is contributing to that because he's played well, but that's still outstanding and probably a little bit of a fluctuation due to luck as well. Anyway, looks like he continues to earn more playing time. It's just not exactly clear where that's going to come from because Carr and Jimmy Smith are both playing pretty well.
All right, last player I want to ask you about is C.J. Mosley.
Okay, so Mosley had a run around the field game against the run. He did the best he could given some really lousy circumstances. He was the player making more tackles on the outside than anybody else, and these runs got away. He had some good backfield penetration that included two tackles for loss. But Ben Roethlisberger picked on him in the middle of the field, and I think a lot of their offensive scheme was to isolate Mosley versus crossing patterns, whether it was a tight end or a wide receiver in the middle of the field. And they did a very good job of that. Jesse James beat him for an 18-yard play. I'm trying to remember the others in here as well. Let me go back here for a sec. But, yeah, he was beaten by James for 18. There was a pass between to Bell where either Levine or him might have been responsible that was 0 plus 18 yaks, another 18-yard play. Smith-Schuster, who's a wide receiver and fast, beat him for an 11-yard cross, and then Smith-Schuster for another 17-yard cross lately. So you can see the pattern that was really part of their plan, was to isolate Mosley.
All right, so even though it was a loss, I'm going to let you still give out some defensive MVPs because it's not the defense that killed this team this week. It's the 32nd-ranked offense.
Yep, I have to go along with you on that. Okay, so we go from 3-1, right? My number three star is Patrick Onwuesoh. Big game, really looked good in it, and showed a lot of the speed necessary to make some plays on the outside that we'd seen probably more of from Correa to date. Do you want to go to with this?
No, I'm letting you go with the MVPs.
All right, life is good. So number two is Jimmy Smith. The play alone on Brown might have been enough. I really debated whether he should be number one or number two, but Brown being held down was a terrific accomplishment. Jimmy Smith gets the most credit for that, but it was a shared effort, and Jimmy Smith didn't play the entire game. So I'm going with Jimmy Smith at number two. Number one guy, Willie Henry, just an outstanding set of pass rush events in a relatively small number of snaps available, and he's the guy I'm most hopeful to emerge as a star over the remainder of the year here. So I'm very hopeful of that.
All right, good. That's someone to keep watching and get excited for this season. See, my my defensive MVPs are only fun if we win, because that's when I get to say, well, it was Antonio Brown. Because yes. It was fun to see him frustrated on the sideline, but that's not a fun joke in one when you lost 26-9.
You're right. There's somebody out there saying, shut the hell up, Josh.
Exactly, exactly. So, yes, it was fun to see him frustratedly throw the Gatorade cooler down, but we can't pinpoint that because in the end the Ravens lost.
Now, I missed that. On the Antonio Brown had a Gatorade incident?
Yeah. I'm 99% sure it was Antonio Brown. That ripped the Gatorade down and was frustrated because the ball wasn't being thrown to him.
Good deal.
So that might have helped with the ball later getting thrown to him for us to intercept.
Because he got a lot of Gatorade all over him?
Well, I meant more of him whining for the ball.
Ah, got it.
So, okay. But let's get to the mailbag because these people are probably smarter than me. And we'll go with we'll start with Zero Hour Anderson. The defensive woes are due to the scheme, the play calling, or the players not playing up to their ability. What do you think?
All right. Well, right now, I think if I had to say anything, it's the players because of the injuries. That they really miss Brandon Williams and Urban in this game. I think the defense is actually very solid. The fears I had about how badly that second ILB spot would hurt the Ravens really have not come true. Correa and Onwuesoh, between the two of them, have played well enough in total to be decent. You know, it certainly hasn't been a gaping hole. The pass rush has maybe not been what the team has hoped since week two, certainly. But if I had to pick anything, I'd say it's the injuries which are now hurting the team.
And injuries are tough because we've lost major parts to this team on injury. Mm-hmm. And the question is, how long is it going to take this team to play better than they are now and play with the backups?
Right. I mean, they have backup talent on that line. So, you know, if players like Henry could step forward, Kafusi had a tough game in his first outing, you know, but maybe he comes and really contributes something on the pass rush. He was only in there for three pass snaps in this game. So I want to see him get his arms up and try and deflect a pass or two, and then we'll get excited about who intercepts those. So hopefully still we got some talent.
All right. Let's go to the next tweet. And remember, this is the Film Study Mailbag. # Film Study Mailbag on Twitter to get your questions in for Ken McCusick. At Macamiller says, is this Correa peanut experiment working at inside linebacker? Or do we need to stick with just one of them? Or do we need to find someone else?
Okay, so all three are options. So platoon, pick one, or somebody else. If I had to give one of the choices, my choice to start the season would have been pick somebody else. Get Gerald Hodges specifically, who's been sitting out there for a while, legitimate two-down run stuffer, can come in and help the defense in some significant ways. But how they've played so far, it really hasn't been what's taken down the team. So, hey, you know, I probably wouldn't pick yet if I were Dean Pease. I'd let this go another week. I'd see if either of them can step up. Maybe there's some additional component of focus or rest that actually is having an impact on this, but I'd let it go. And I would not go out to the street now and buy somebody at this point. Hodges would still have some expense to him, and I don't think it's worth spending more money on this team at this point. I want to not borrow from future years' cap.
All right. Gabe Fergie, at Gabe Fergie. P. PFF grades Weddle/Jefferson very poorly in run D. Do you see the same? Any thoughts on why Humphrey isn't given any reps at SCB? Where am I blanking
slot,
on this?
Slot corner.
Slot corner. There we go. Seems odd to take off Jimmy unless he needs the rest.
Okay, so let's kind of take these one at a time. First of all, Gabe Ferguson is a local blogger who does a really good job, and you can find his stuff, I believe, on BSL. So if you look for that, you'll
Baltimore
find it.
Baltimore Sports and Life.
Yeah, good analytic blogger. So anyway, let's start with Humphrey for a second. Humphrey is forcing his way in because he's outstanding, and you can't let a first-round rookie rot on the bench. But he's just too good to sit right now. The problem is the Ravens have two good corners. So Fergie's asking, or Gabe is asking, should we move him to slot corner? And my answer on that is no. He's going to play outside for his career because he has aircraft carrier size. And what I mean by that is he's over 6 feet tall, 6'1". Long corners do better on the outside where they can use their length and use the boundary as well to defend with. And he also has press value there. Putting him in the slot, it's not that he couldn't succeed there. It's just it wouldn't be the right fit. What you really want is change of direction there and very quick reaction time. And it's not exactly what he is. And I'd rather not distract him the way we distracted Correa or Michael Orr or other players in the past by having him play two different positions.
All right. Makes sense. One more question from at Josh Soroka. Is two ugly losses like this enough to warm up the hot seat?
For who?
John Harbaugh.
Okay, for John Harbaugh. Well, John just signed for the next year, so I think that may have been an admission.
That's a locker room talk. That's a put the team behind them. Don't let things get all shaken up in the locker room. Or do you think that's an admission of this season's not going to go great because of injuries?
Yeah, I think that's where I am more. I don't disagree with you because they signed. I think they had just signed Billick, and he was 1 year into a 5 year deal or 4 year deal. When they fired him, so it's Bisciotti will not. It won't be the money that'll be a big serious concern. So he said, John, look, I'll sign you for next year, but if I don't see improvement, I'm still firing you, and you'll get to walk with a little more money. This is a severance package, effectively, I'm building for you.
Right, and remember, the big thing with Billick was he lost the team.
That's right.
And there's lots of questions of that locker room after the case. So if there's, John Harbaugh is in a different situation.
I agree. I mean, I think John Harbaugh, I don't believe, has lost this team. I mean, there are things. He's very irascible, and he can get. But Billick had an aloofness about him that made him. There were elements of him that he could be player's coach because he was smart and he knew what players wanted, and he could give that to them. But he was still somebody who was manipulating coins to adapt to a result, as opposed to someone who truly related eye to eye with the players. I believe Harbaugh has more of that. Okay. Ability to really relate to the players directly.
All right. I think that's good to hear. I mean, I don't want to, especially at week four, don't want to have to worry about that hot seat too much.
Mm-hmm.
All right, Ken, I want everyone to go on over to Russell Street Report and read your articles where you get even more in-depth than we can do in this 30, 40-minute podcast.
Yeah, so you get more detail. It's film study at Russell Street Report. You look for Ken Film Study Ravens. You'll find it as well. Follow me on Twitter, please, at Film Study Ravens. And we're very active in the discussion there. We have a great group of analysts who go back and forth a lot with some great Ravens topics if you want to tune in there. And Josh, how about you? You run a really great local podcast.
Yeah, so I got a podcast called Section 336. We talk a lot of sports. We talk a lot of Orioles, a lot of Ravens, and whatever else is going on locally in sports. Very lighthearted, have a lot of fun with my brother and brother-in-law to do it. This week's episode will be kind of closing out the Orioles season, and I guess I'm sure we'll talk a little bit about this Ravens game from a fan's perspective, and prepare ourselves for the offseason. Of Major League Baseball, as well as a little bit of the postseason with looking at some of the other teams who have made it.
So where do you expect the Orioles to spend their money this offseason? Is it going to be buying starting position pitchers, or would you be happy, let's start with that, if they went after Scope and Machado long-term only?
I want Machado long-term, and then I don't care. I would love to bring in starting pitching. I think that anyone who's asking for good starting pitching this offseason is crazy. The starting pitching market this season is really poor. A guy that I would want, that I would think normally the Orioles could afford, is a guy like Alex Cobb, because a big thing for me is proven that you can pitch in the AL East. I think we've brought decent pitchers in from the National League, and then guys like Ubaldo, who had one of the best National League seasons in Colorado, which makes no sense to pitch well in Colorado, could not handle it in the American League. And I think we've seen that over and over again with guys like Jake Arrieta leave Baltimore and excel in Chicago. So I'm tired of bringing in guys who were good elsewhere. So I want a pitcher like Alex Cobb who can pitch in the AL East and succeed. The problem is the pitching market's so poor, he's going to end up being like the third, fourth best pitcher on the market, which raises the price of all mediocre pitchers.
Right. Well, that's a good year not to buy pitching, even if you're concerned about it. You know, pitching already is risky in my mind. The contract given to Price, you know, 7 years, right, $217 million, $31 million a year, whatever it was, it's just so far beyond ridiculous, it doesn't make sense. I mean, there is risk in signing a player like Chris Davis for not that exact amount, but a lot of money, yes, or 7 years, but there's a lot less risk with the hitter than there is with the pitcher.
Yeah, and so you can go two moves. You can spend a whole lot of money on this season and say, we got to win now, or you can sign Manny long-term, which we've talked about on 336, and we'll continue to talk about how the Orioles can afford Manny Machado even at the numbers like $400 million. That sounds like a ton of money, but when you break it down, they can afford that. And if you sign a guy like Manny, then that window opens up wider where you can develop your pitchers a little longer and you don't have to win it all next year.
Right.
So also want to tell people, thank you for listening to the show. We're getting real good response from the show, and I want people to go on over to iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts and write reviews. We got two reviews this week I wanted to highlight. One on iTunes from Nugget710, who says, this is the best Ravens podcast. Hands down, the best Ravens-related podcast there is. It's not even close. And then another guy called Dan Excel, who also titled his best Ravens podcast. He says, this is exactly what I've been looking for. Ken breaks down the game unlike any other Raven analyst or reporter I've heard thus far. Very good insights into the game and player performances. I recommend this podcast to any Ravens fan and want more insight into the game. Little reviews like that really help people to find the show and trust that this is the podcast that they should be listening to each week. So thank you for those reviews.
Those are real nice to hear, and we really appreciate the quality of the questions as well. So please continue to contribute to Film Study Mailbag as time goes forward.
Yep, hashtag Film Study Mailbag. And we will be back in a day or two to look at the offense, where Joe Flacco sucks, but somehow we'll still talk about the offense. All right, Ken, have a good night.
You too.